So we've been talking about watershed, the idea that the life, death, resurrection of Jesus is this watershed moment in human history, that after this, nothing is ever the same. Now, you can not believe in Jesus. You can say that Jesus wasn't who he said he was. You can say that he didn't rise from the dead. You can say that he didn't even die, and he was just hiding out in the wilderness somewhere. But what you can't say is that human history was the same after his life and death. So when you go back and you look at the things that happened in history between the death of Jesus and the present day, you have to say that our history is marked by the life of Jesus. So a watershed moment is a moment in history where things change, where they diverge into two paths and they never come back together again. Our world, our planet, our human history will never be the same again after the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. And so as we're continuing on past Easter, I was thinking, what should I title the next few weeks? Because what I want to talk about is the difference that knowing Jesus made in the lives of a few specific people who are really close to him. And the word I kept coming up with is a word I didn't want to use, and you'll know why in a minute. But it's the word divergent. And the reason I don't want to use the word divergent is because it's like there's some teen fiction book that's really popular and there's a movie that goes with it. It's a really confusing idea that after the apocalypse, only Chicago is safe. Somehow Chicago survives the apocalypse. So it's a great film. You should go see it, really. Or not. Either way. This word divergent was in my head, maybe because I was dragged to that film, maybe because it expresses what I'm trying to say. So I looked up the definition. The definition is moving apart or following paths or courses that become increasingly different or separate. Secondary definition, not matching something, deviating from something such as a typical pattern. That is the perfect description for what happened to the closest friends of Jesus after his life and death and resurrection. They became 100% different. They deviated from their typical pattern. They became something so much more than they were. And on the day of Pentecost, you have Peter, who's afraid of a slave girl, standing up and speaking, and 3,000 people deciding to become Christians. Things radically changed for them. So I just decided, well, maybe this will just help us get Google click-through links accidentally, right? We'll just go ahead and call it divergent and move on with our lives. I liked this picture, though. It's like these ribbons going through the city here. I think of us that way. I think of us when we go out from here, that we spread out into all areas of our community and we become light in color in kind of a gray world. So I thought that picture was pretty cool. Anywho, I'm going to call it divergent, and maybe somebody will accidentally click on us instead of the movie about Chicago surviving the apocalypse. Last week we talked about the idea that Jesus' death and resurrection is this watershed moment, and we see the results in the lives of his followers. The resurrection we talked about is the most important thing. If Jesus doesn't rise from the dead, then our faith is absolutely pointless. In fact, Paul says, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then you are to be pitied among all people, and we are liars. All of the things that we have said is not true because Jesus didn't rise, and if there's no resurrection, Jesus didn't rise. So the resurrection is everything, but if Jesus did rise, then everything about our life is different now. Everything about human history is different because our one mortal enemy, the one thing you can't beat is death, and Jesus beat death and has power over death. So that's important, and that changes things. And we're going to look at how some of Jesus' closest friends wrote about who Jesus was. These guys were eyewitnesses. They spent time with him. So their opinion matters to me. Their experiences are valid to me. These are people who walked and talked and were together with Jesus, and they write later in their life about him. We're going to talk about John this week. John was a disciple of Jesus. He was probably really, really young when Jesus and the disciples were walking around, and he was very, very close with Jesus. Sometimes he's called the Beloved. because he was just, he had a very close relationship with Jesus. And John's experience of Jesus is really centered around love. In fact, when he writes the epistles, John, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, you can find literally dozens, there's probably 37 references to the word love, and about probably in the high 20s of them are specifically talking about God's love revealed through Jesus. So I was going to call this week All You Need Is Love, but my problem is that's a Beatles song, and I was not raised by baby boomers as I should have been. My parents were like born in the 30s and grew up in the Great Depression and during World War II, so they were literally old enough to be the parents of the Beatles. So like that whole thing, the whole 60s thing, that all of my friends, their parents were really into the 60s and into the Beatles and into all these different 60s things, I never heard any of it. I had no idea what any of this stuff was. But I did grow up in the 1980s, and my experience of the term All You Need Is Love was a little more specific to the 1984 power ballad recorded by the British American rock group Foreigner. Oh, there they are. Yeah. That's back when hair was awesome. I think we need to go back to this day when a man can wear a perm without fear. They wrote a song, their number one hit, I Want to Know What Love Is. You know, I want to know what love is. Okay, I won't sing it, but you are welcome. I will not sing. Love is the subject, if you think about it, of a good chunk. I dare say a majority of our pop culture tunes are about love or trying to find love or finding love for an evening, that kind of a thing. And we might mock cheesy 80s power ballads, and for good reason, but the truth is we are definitely searching. We want to know what love is. At least half of our movies are about love. Victor Hugo said, the greatest happiness of life is the conviction that we are loved. Love for ourselves, or rather, loved in spite of ourselves. Oscar Wilde said, who being loved is poor? And if I start quoting song lyrics, we'll be here all night, so I'll move on from there. But a while back, we figured out that those who have the hardest time loving are those who have never been shown love. And this is kind of you see a shift in the last 15 years in pop culture where we don't just have heroes and villains anymore. We have heroes, and we also have flawed heroes who weren't loved, or maybe were loved too much, or whatever. And we also have villains that we're trying to understand, right? You watch a movie now, and the villain can't just be a villain. He can't just be evil. He can't just be bad. He's got to be bad because he was not loved properly. I remember, this is the reason he's violent or a bully. This is the reason villains become villains, right? A while back, you remember the Grinch Who Stole Christmas, and they made a movie out of this with Jim Carrey in it? The thing that struck me was, before the movie, I was like, The Grinch Who Stole Christmas is basically a long poem. It's not really all that long. It's just a little short children's book. So how are they going to make an entire hour and a half minimum movie about The Grinch Who Stole Christmas? Well, obviously they have to add things. And one of the things they added was the backstory of the Grinch. Do you guys remember this? Like the Grinch was in school, and he was ugly, and he was green, and he had a pointy head. And so kids picked on him. And that's why the Grinch's heart was two sizes too small. It's not enough to just say he was the Grinch, and he was grumpy, and he lived on Mount Crumpet, and he was angry because he didn't understand Christmas. No, he was angry because he was picked on. There's a Broadway play called Wicked, which is billed as a cautionary tale about love, friendship, and trust. It effortlessly reveals that there are indeed two sides to every story. The idea is that the Wicked Witch of the West wasn't so wicked. She was actually just very misunderstood, and she was treated poorly, and that's why she's a bad person. Our understanding of love is often limited by how we have been loved. What love is very often limited by how I've experienced love. Who has loved me and how have they loved me? To know love, to give love, I must first be loved. And some people say, no, absolutely not. It must all come from within yourself. Really? You ever know anyone who was just very unloved? Was very rejected and was, you know, an outcast who really had a whole lot of love in their heart that wasn't in a movie. When I am loved unconditionally, sacrificially, it empowers me to love others. I can love deeply because I am loved. I can love deeply because I'm secure, I'm safe. I have love to give to other people. And so John understands Jesus through the lens of love. And if you read 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, there are these almost syrupy kinds of letters where John uses phrases like little children and dear brothers and sisters, and he speaks in a very loving, warm kind of a language. And we're going to look at a little bit from 1 John 3 and 4. Here's what he says. More on a section called More on Love and Hatred. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. Isn't that really specific? He doesn't say, this is how we know one facet of love. He didn't say, this is how love might be explained in one certain way, but it's different for everybody. No. Universally, for everyone across the planet, this is how we know what love is. Foreigner, I want to know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. You see, there's this reciprocal relationship. Jesus laid down his life for us. We lay down our life for others. If anyone has material possessions, sees a brother or sister in need, but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but in actions and truth. This is how we know what love is. That such great love from Jesus demands a response in our life. Our response is to love others, and love goes beyond words. Real love requires that we take action. Let's read that in the Message. We'll stick in the Message for a few verses. If you see some brother or sister in need and have the means to do something about it, but turn a cold shoulder and do nothing, what happens to God's love? It disappears, and you made it disappear. Let's practice real love. This is the only way we'll know we're living truly, living in God's reality. It's also the way to shut down debilitating self-criticism, even when there's something to it. For God is greater than our worried hearts and knows more about us than we do ourselves. And friends, once that's taken care of, we're no longer accusing or condemning ourselves. We're bold and free before God. We're able to stretch our hands out and receive what we asked for because we're doing what he said, doing what pleases him. Again, this is God's command, to believe in his personally named son, Jesus Christ. He, meaning Jesus, told us to love each other. In line with the original command, as we keep his commands, we live deeply and surely in him, and he lives in us. And this is really specific. John doesn't say, well, God showed love to us, therefore we should do whatever we want with that. He's really specific. God showed who he is. He showed that he loved us by giving his son Jesus. And our response to that is, first, we must believe that. We must believe that God sent his son and that he died for us. That's the beginning of real love. This is how we know what love is, that God sent his son for us, that we believe in Jesus, and believing in Jesus, we receive God's love, and then we can give that love out to everyone in our world. But it all begins with believing in Jesus. And we have an idea in our culture, we were talking about it last week, that really this is one way to understand love. This is one way to understand God. But there are a lot of ways to understand God. There's a lot of ways to approach love. And John says, no, it's very simple. It starts here. And if you want to experience real love, true love, sacrificial love, the love that was created from the beginning of the world and extends to you today, you have to begin with Jesus. I like how Peterson translates that. Believe in his personally named son, Jesus Christ. Meaning, not some Christ figure, or some Christ idea or some ideal of goodness, but a person. If you want to understand what love is, you look at a person, Jesus Christ. Moving on to chapter 4. Dear friends, John is so warm. I like that about him. John always sounds like the kind of guy I just would want to go over to his house and hang out for a while and just feel better about myself. Oh, dear children, dear friends. He's probably a little older by this time. This is probably 30 years later, we're guessing. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. That's not that verse there, but it's down here. I'll read it, and then we'll get to that one in a second. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. This is how God showed his love among us. He's going to say it again because he says it several times. He sent his one and only Son into the world so that we might live through him. This is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. There's a line in one of the songs from Les Miserables. I don't think it's in the actual Victor Hugo book, but it says, to love another person is to see the face of God. It comes from this idea from 1 John 4. No one's ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us. This is love, not that we loved God, not that we said, ah, yes, God, I will seek you out and give you my love because I'm such a wonderful person, or I'm going to do all of these wonderful good things and then you will love me because I've done all these good things. No, not that we love God, but that God loved us and sent his Son. Now to this verse. In the world, we are like Jesus. What he's saying is we have the same status as Jesus in God's eyes. That means that we're not condemned. That means we're not under a curse. That means that when we ask for something, we can receive it if we ask in accordance with God's will, because there's no disconnection between us and God. There is no fear in love. But perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. We love, again, because he first loved us. Whoever claims to love God yet hates his brother or sister is a liar. Whoever does not love their brother and sister whom they have not seen cannot love God whom they have seen. And he's given us this command. Anyone who loves God must also love their brother and sister. So this is how John sees it. He sees it all coming out of love. He sees it all connected to love. He sees the beginning of love as understanding that Jesus came for us and believing in Jesus. And when you begin by believing in Jesus, from there you receive and are able to give an inexpressible and very different and wholly divergent kind of love that the world that we live in doesn't understand but desperately needs, that they do not possess outside of Jesus, but we are able to extend. I was minding my own business at work a couple of weeks ago. It was right before Easter. I was sitting before a team meeting. One of the teams that I lead was about to start, and this conversation started. Somebody was talking about, for some reason, they were talking about cultures around the world that used to practice human sacrifice, like the Aztecs and the Mayas. And you're like, okay, I'm not sure how this conversation started, but I'm going to listen to it because it's interesting. And it was going on, and they were talking, and one of the guys says, well, they were talking about, you know, human sacrifices for your sins, and he kind of jokingly says, well, I'm a Christian, so we only believe in having to sacrifice one guy for everybody, for all of their sins. And another person spoke up and said, yeah, you know, that's the thing that always bugged me. Growing up, my grandma would take me to church and to Sunday school, and when I was 4 years old, here's what I said. They said, Jesus went to the cross, and died for your sins. And I said, why? I would have just said no. And my Sunday school teacher was really mad at me. she said, that's the problem I always have with it. I wouldn't go to the cross. I would just say no. And I try to be kind of careful, you know, that I'm not being overbearing with these kinds of things. But I was sitting there thinking of what she said and how a four-year-old brain goes, yeah, I would have just said no to the cross. Yeah, I would have just said, no, that's pain and that's agony and I don't want to go through it. And it went out of my mouth before my brain could catch it. And I went, yeah, that's what makes it so amazing. Because I would have said no too. And you would have said no. And we all would have said no. And Jesus going to the cross is the ultimate act of love. And it teaches us something about love that we in and of ourselves are not capable of understanding until we see it modeled for us and done in front of us. Jesus says, I love you so much that I won't say no, even though I can. When you believe in Jesus, you are forgiven, free, deeply, unconditionally, sacrificially loved. This is love, right? Not that I loved God, but that God loved me and gave everything up for me. And when you are deeply and sacrificially loved like that, not only must you love others, not only is it just on you that I have to love other people too, but you actually can. Because when you're so full up of love, when you're supported and when you're loved and when all of the things you've done wrong don't matter, when you have someone who is behind you like that, you're actually capable of loving other people. You're actually capable of letting them be themselves and you can forgive. I don't only understand that I should forgive, but I can. And I want everyone to know that kind of love. And this, when I read John, I love reading John because growing up, this was one of the things that I had a hard time understanding. I wondered if anyone loved me. And when I met Jesus, I understood that I never had to wonder about that again because beginning with an understanding of who Jesus is tells me that I am loved beyond anything I could even conceive of myself. I can love because Jesus loved me. I can forgive because God forgives me. I can give because Jesus gave me everything. That's what John is trying to say, that all of this changes, that everything is different because not because I loved God, not because I chose him, but because he chose me and he loved me and Jesus went to the cross and that changes absolutely everything. So, some table talk. Let's talk about this tonight. Have you, maybe that one? All right. Cool, there it is. Have you had the same experience with God that John had and describes, this close connection? We love because he loved us, understanding God's immense love. Has that been your experience? Why? Why not? Do you have a hard time accepting any of this? Any of the things that I'm saying tonight about needing to be loved in order to love or whatever else we've talked about that you're confused about? Let's maybe talk about that. Third, John says we must love in word and deed. What are some practical ways you could love someone in your life this week? So why don't we divvy up the tables a little bit, make sure everybody has somebody to talk to, and take some time on that. And about 7 o'clock, we'll be officially done. I don't have any wrap-up tonight, so you guys can just wander off when you're done. Have a great night.